Hello and welcome to Afternoonified,
the podcast that's asking you to send us all your cool rocks. I'm Sarah.
And I'm Emily. What exactly is the punchline?
There isn't any. I just like rocks. I think they're neat.
Please don't send us rocks.
Don't listen to her. Send us rocks. But cool rocks only.
That was me reading the cold open for the first time in real time.
It makes it feel very genuine. I like
good,
it.
Good. Episode tentatively titled Hoaxes to Judgment Day.
That actually, I got that in the link to the podcastle room. And I was like, you know, that's actually a pretty accurate title because I will be judging all of these people very harshly.
That's why I landed on it, because I was thinking of other famous sequels. So you've got Hoaxes to the Squeakquel.
Of course, that's my working title.
Too Hoax, Too Furious, obvious, overdone. Electric Hoaxaloo, which I didn't know how to spell. you could also just go with, because we would have had to title the first one Hoax, and then this one would be Hoaxes to follow.
See, that's why we need to plan our schedules 4 years in advance. I actually don't know how long it's been since I did the original Hoax episode.
A long enough time.
We're doing hoaxes again because there are a lot of hoaxes. And also, this was the only episode topic I could think of that didn't involve dead children.
Yeah, we need to like get you in to see someone about that.
I'm clearly working through something. I don't know.
I don't want to know what.
I can promise that there are, in fact, no dead children. There are some embarrassed men.
Which is
so that's fun.
Fine.
Yes. So thank you to my sources. History.com, a blog article for the Smithsonian by Alexandria K. Elvis. Atlas Obscura, Wikipedia, Science Magazine, Encyclopedia Britannica, the Museum of Hoaxes, and Archaeology Magazine.
Can I just say God bless Atlas Obscura?
God, they're the best. They're my favorite source. I always get really excited when like an article comes up when I Google things. So we're going to be covering a lot of like archaeology flavored hoaxes.
Yeah.
So put on your Indiana Jones hat. None of these things belong in a museum.
I feel like we're kind of in our listicle era right now, which I don't mind.
I love a good listicle episode. I love getting to learn about a bunch of little things.
It's, well, because you get less, it's a little more surface level on stuff, but I don't know, I think they're fun. And if it means that I don't have to try to sort through like 500 years of Roman Empire history, like, by all means.
And I mean, I like it that we get to cover like a lot of things that, you know, wouldn't be a full episode on their own.
Exactly.
We can put a bunch of them together and call it a theme. We are going to start today with Beringer's Lying Stones.
Well, it's right there.
It's right there in the title. You'd think that after naming them his lying stones, he'd question it. But no, the name came later. But so, in 1725, Dr. Johann Beringer was a senior professor and dean of the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Würzburg in Germany. Beringer was deeply fascinated by natural history, particularly the study of what at the time was referred to as oryctics, or things dug from the earth. So paleontology. He was also really into fossils, or as they were called at the time, petrifactions, I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, he likes digging in the dirt. He hired other people to dig in the dirt for him, but he liked the things that were from the dirt.
We were watching one of those like ancient Egypt documentaries last night, because that's how I shut my brain off. But they were talking about this old white British guy who like excavated this area, but then they're like, and then they came to the last tomb and found that it was flooded. So they sent in a very reluctant worker. Like, yeah, he sat in a tent and like took notes. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Sounds about right. So Beringer kept a cabinet of curiosities in which he displayed his collection of interesting objects from around the world, and had hired three local boys to go dig around in the dirt at the nearby Mount Eibelstadt, to bring him anything interesting. So literally
God, I want my own cabinet of curiosities.
I know. Someday. Starting in May 1725, Berger's diggers began bringing him fascinating finds. Stones bearing the images of plants, insects, birds, and snails, and even astronomical objects. Like one of the first stones they brought him, it had the sun on it.
So not like fossilized, like snail shells, like you can find, but like drawings on them?
Yes. But he was still under the impression that they were, in fact, fossils.
And we were dumb.
Even when they started bringing him stones bearing Hebrew letters.
You know, fossilized alphabet soup from ancient Israel.
So over the next few months, they managed to bring him nearly 2,000 stones. Berger, he was rightfully puzzled by this. But to be fair, this is 1725. We don't exactly know a lot about fossils or like what causes them or what they are. They had some questions. And there was still a lot of debate as to, you know, all of these little details. So rather than be skeptical, like, you know, us in our modern era might be, he was like, wow, this is fascinating. I wonder what explains this.
I feel like we were, I'm not going to use gullible. It's just, we hadn't figured out what other people can do yet. You know,
we also, yeah, I was thinking about this because like, it's not that like human beings today are any smarter than human beings were 400 years ago. It's just that we don't have that 400 years of knowledge. Or we do have that 400 years of knowledge. They didn't. Like, that's a cumulative thing. So
we didn't have the lived experience.
Yeah. And to be fair, like, these fossils were turning up, or like, not these fossils, they're not fossils, spoiler alert, these rocks, these cool pictures, they were turning up at the same site where there were actually fossils being found. So they were mixed in with like legitimate fossils. So Berger was like, oh, so they must be real.
He has no reason to think that they wouldn't be.
Yeah. So he's decided he simply must write about these crazy rocks. Compiling all his theories into a dissertation he titled Lithographiae Wurzburgensis. I did not pronounce that correctly. It means a Wurzburg lithography, except like cool and in Latin. And he published this in early 1726. The title page boasted that the book was, quote, illustrated with over 200 extraordinary engravings. And the dissertation itself was ostensibly authored by one of his grad students, George Ludwig Huber, though the most noble, illustrious, and learned, Berger received top billing.
Of course. Hold on. Minnie, can you shut up, please? Just like do me a solid and shut the- You were on the counter, you little shit! No, you don't get pets for that. Are you kidding? Please continue. She was just sitting on my kitchen counter yelling.
I'm glad one of our cats must be a menace at all times. It's
God, hairy little felon.
So in his writing, Berger considered many different theories about the stones and how they disproved so many of the popular theories of fossils being discussed at the time. Like one of the ideas was that fossils were all relics of the great flood of the Bible. So like that, you know, Berger looked at this. He's like, no, that's bunk, because the flood happened in the spring, obviously. And one of his stones has a picture of an acorn on it.
Okay. Well, this is also why I think we need to not be afraid of new science that disproves old science.
Mm-hmm.
Just sometimes we were wrong about stuff. We might be wrong about stuff right now, but
we are absolutely wrong about stuff right now. And, you know, that's the nice part about science, is that people keep studying and learning and things change.
There is a quote from Men in Black. I know, but it seems appropriate. And I'm going to try to hunt this down.
I'm so thrilled.
Okay. So this is Tommy Lee Jones.
I know exactly what you're about to say. I just remembered this part of the movie. Go ahead.
A person is smart. People are dumb, panicky, dangerous animals, and you know it. 1,500 years ago, everybody knew the Earth was the center of the universe. 500 years ago, everybody knew the Earth was flat. And 15 minutes ago, you knew that humans were alone on this planet. Imagine what you'll know tomorrow.
That's actually quite profound.
It really, really is.
Thanks, Tommy Lee Jones.
Such a good fucking movie.
A classic, for sure. So, Berger eventually concluded that the stones, you know, obviously they could have only been carved by God. Probably as he was trying to figure out what the world should look like.
It's a Big obviously. Fucking leap, man.
They had been left on the mountain either as a gift for the Bishop of Würzburg or maybe just a fun puzzle for Berenger himself to figure it out. You know, God personally left him these stones, thinking, you know, in about a few millennia, Berenger is going to come along and he's going to think this is real neat.
If he had just kept along the, like, I don't know what these are, let's find out instead of God is speaking to me through rocks, I would have been more on his side, but now he's lost me.
To his credit, he did entertain the idea that the stones could have been man-made, either attributed to some ancient German people or a modern-day hoax. The former was ridiculous, obviously, because pagans didn't know Hebrew. And while there were already whispers of the hoax theory, Berenger dismissed them outright. These were rumors spread by jealous colleagues to undermine his work, of course.
Meaning he was in too deep.
By this point, his diggers had brought him over 2,000 stones, which in his mind was like way too many for like one hoaxer to create from scratch. And like, even if they did, why would anyone put in all the time and effort on a single prank?
Was he paying them per stone? Is this like a Burke and Hare situation?
Not quite. So, as the story goes, it was only after the first copies of this dissertation had been printed that Berenger's diggers presented him with one final stone carved with his own name. There are other versions of the story that claim a local bishop eventually broke the news to him. Either way, conclusion was the same. It had indeed all been a hoax, masterminded by two of his university colleagues, mathematician J. Ignaz Roderick and librarian George von Eckert.
Nerd pranks are some of the meanest pranks.
This is, I'm not to spoil the rest of the episode, this will not be the only prank in this episode.
It stops being a prank once he puts time into a dissertation.
So 17-year-old Christian Zanger, who was one of the hired diggers, had also been aware of the plot. He claimed the whole thing had been done because they found his colleagues found Berenger to be insufferable and arrogant and just thought he needed to be taken down a peg.
Well, he did think that God was talking to him through rocks, so...
Humiliated, Berenger did his best to buy up all the copies of his book that he could get his hands on. They're now extremely rare, and many have been sold for upwards of $10,000. So, I mean, that's an accomplishment, I think.
Imagine what he'll know tomorrow.
Berenger would eventually bring criminal charges against Roderick and Eckert, which, honestly, yeah, you should probably...
Yeah.
And he won the case. Christian Zanger testified against them, having lost all loyalty to the pair after they failed to pay him for his polishing services.
Fair enough. Also, I think this is exactly what the phrase criminal mischief was made to describe. Like, this is the kind of shenanigans.
That would be an accurate charge for this one. Roderick and Eckert both lost their jobs. Roderick had to leave Würzburg entirely, and Eckert was dead within 5 years. So neither of them...
Unrelated, or...?
Yeah, I think he just... It was not related, but he just died because it's 1725. But
that's true.
There's no happy ending for either of them. So those are the lying stones.
It's sadder than I thought it was going to be. Poor guy. Even if he was a pain in the ass.
I think he probably was exactly as insufferable as they alleged that he was. Clearly. But like, that's a lot of work.
To stick it to someone for being rocks. Annoying.
Yeah. Like, I could see maybe like a dozen. But like, at some point, it's like, what are you getting out of this? I don't know.
At that point, it's just sad to be the two people doing it, because it's like, he's furthering what he thinks is his field of research. You're carving shit on stones to mess with a guy who, like, maybe microwaved fish in the break room.
Yeah. Like, don't you have anything better to spend your time on than carving fake rocks? Guess not. So speaking of rocks.
More rocks.
More rocks. Lots of rocks in this episode. Rocks and bones. In 1820, near the town of Pompey, New York, a farmer named Philo Cleveland, what a great name, was clearing a patch of meadow on his farm, Stardew Valley style, when he dug up a strange stone. When he dug up a strange stone. Actually, this is pretty Stardew Valley. You're cleaning up, like, your farm, and you dig around, and the strange rock comes up. Yeah, that's very Stardew Valley.
Okay, yes.
It was oval in shape, approximately 14 by 12 by 10 inches in size. And weighed about 127 pounds. Yeah, it's a big rock.
Boulder.
Yeah.
When does it become a boulder?
I think when it weighs over 100 pounds.
Okay.
In my opinion.
No, you didn't like look it up. This is just...
If I can't lift it, it's a boulder. Yeah.
Hold on.
I don't think there's a technical definition for a boulder.
There has to be. Difference between rock and...
Boulders are bigger.
This is not helpful. It's commonly used for one that's large and difficult to move. In geology, a boulder is a rock with a grain size of usually no less than 256 millimeters in diameter.
See, so if it gets too big to lift it, you can't do it.
If it's bigger than 10 inches across, it's geologically a boulder.
Oh, there you go. Oh, there is an exact measurement. Interesting. Well, this was definitely a boulder then, because it was bigger than that. So at first he didn't even notice it. He had been digging up a lot of big rocks, as you do. But when he stopped to take a break, he noticed that it seemed to have some sort of strange inscription. At its center, the stone bore the image of a tree being climbed by a serpent, engraved with the words Leo de L on VI, like the Roman numeral, 1520.
I'm just going to go ahead and say, if you find a rock and there's something carved in it, probably not as old as you think it is.
It usually isn't. So now very curious, Cleveland brought the stone to a blacksmith in nearby Watervale, where it quickly became an attraction. Visitors would stop by the shop, and some even took nails and files to the stone in an attempt to dig out the inscription, which, you know, obviously this is going to be revealed as a hoax because that's the episode we're doing. But can you imagine if it was real? They're just like taking nails to it.
It's like the archaeological equivalent of people like stealing shit from active crime scenes in the early 1900s.
I think about the crime scene where there was like a cake on the table and people they were taking pieces of cake. So it was later moved to the village of Manlius, I believe, which is an interesting name for a town, where it was analyzed by several scientists and historians and declared as authentic. The inscription was translated to Leo X by the grace of God, 8th year of his pontificate, 1520.
Sure.
So it's talking about the Pope. So it was accepted as evidence of early European presence in the region. Most assumed it was some sort of grave marker, perhaps for a Spanish explorer or missionary that had died while being held captive by Native Americans. I don't understand where that last connection came from, other than they just assumed. There's not a lot of information on this stone in general that isn't like behind a paywall.
I think it was Cleopatra. Yeah. Like I can't subscribe to all of these websites. I can't purchase all of these books. I'm poor.
Yeah. We don't get paid anything for doing this podcast.
We spend
maybe
money
if we started leaving money in the tip jar, we would put in more effort.
No, that's
it's
not
the
fair.
Listener's fault, Emily. No, it's not. We're just lazy. So
poor. I'm not paying Vox $10 so I can read the rest of an article about a haunted fucking chair.
So the stone hopped from museum to museum over the next few years, and by 1880 it was on display at the New York State Museum of Natural History. Good for the rock.
What's he doing? Is he cooking something? Or you said the rock is on display. It was a Dwayne Johnson joke. Please continue.
I have no words, Emily. It wasn't until 1894, a full 74 years after the stone's discovery, that someone challenged its authenticity, which a little late.
What a pain in the ass that person must have been.
The Reverend William Martin Beauchamp, a local historian and something of an expert on the local Onondaga people, decided to look into the stone after learning it had never actually been seriously scrutinized by anybody. His analysis of the inscription concluded it had been made using modern tools and that the inscription itself was also all wrong for the period it was supposedly from, being written in a modern style rather than how it would have been written by Europeans in the 16th century. Which was, I believe, like his area of expertise. He also pointed out that there were no native tribes in the area during this time, which made the theory that it marked the burial site of a Native American captive even more unlikely. Again, no idea where that even came from, but okay. After publishing his findings in an article in the Syracuse Journal, a local man named John Edson Sweet wrote a letter to the publication revealing that his uncle, Cyrus Avery, had confessed to him all the way back in 1867 that he had created and planted the stone as a joke. The Pompey Stone was pulled from the museum and it would later be displayed again in 1934, this time as an example of a hoax. So,
Why are they going to put this farmer on blast, man? This is just stories of dudes thinking that they found cool shit and then finding out that their friends are assholes.
Most of the time, yeah. That is, you're going to hear this. Yeah, like I said, you're going to hear this story a few times.
Like, just overnight, you go from being like, just I found cool fossils. I'm going to write a paper on it. And then the next day, you're like, oh, I didn't find any cool fossils. And my colleagues apparently hate me.
I will say, it doesn't seem like Philo Cleveland had any, like, he just kind of like, oh, here's cool rock.
Good for him, man.
I think he sold it to, like, the blacksmith. And that was it. And he was done. That's how you handle cool rocks. You just sell it to the first person who will buy it and go about your life. And then
don't
it's
get too
not
invested.
Your problem anymore. Yeah, don't get too invested in any cool rocks.
That's the real moral of this episode.
Yes. So our next story. In February 1866, miners digging on Bald Mountain in Calaveras County, California, discovered a human skull buried 130 feet below the ground in a patch of hardened lava millions of years old.
I can't imagine how this is going to be a hoax.
Passed the skull along to a merchant. He handed off to a local physician, and it eventually wound up in the hands of J.D. Whitney, the state geologist of California and a professor of geology at Harvard University.
That's a job you can have, state geologist.
Mm-hmm. It is in 1866. It probably is still now, but
I hope it's still a job now. We need those.
Yes. So upon examination of the skull and learning where it had been found, Whitney declared that the skull belonged to a man who lived during the Pliocene age, some 2.4 to 5.4 million years ago.
Seems unlikely, but sure.
This, if it was true, big if, made
huge
the skull
if
the,
true.
The oldest known record of humans in North America and suggested that they lived on the continent millions of years before previous estimates.
Didn't that end up being true, but not because of this?
I don't know if it was. I honestly don't know. I couldn't tell you. I don't want to look it up. I don't think so. I think not. Definitely not this old. Like, probably older than we thought at this time. But okay. 2.4 million years is quite a long time ago. Within just a few years, the skull's authenticity was being challenged. So W.H. Holmes, a scientist at the Smithsonian, pointed out that not only did the skull look strikingly modern for a human that was supposed to have lived millions of years ago, but that the sediment that was found on the skull itself did not match the sediment in the mine, which, you know, suggested it may have been planted there. Not helping the matter was the fact that literally no scientist with any expertise in the matter had been able to examine the skull where it was supposedly found. Like, again, like, the miners found it, they gave it to one guy, he gave it to another guy. Like, it changed hands quite a few times before it made it to, you know, someone with who knew anything about skulls.
A random parallel, I don't know, but the same thing happened in the Jack the Ripper case when they got that piece of kidney in the mail.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it went to one guy, and then he's like, huh, weird. So he took it to another guy, I mean, like, what is this? And then they're like, I don't know. So then they took it to a third guy, and he was like, fucked if I know. So then they all went to the hospital to get a doctor to look at it. And they're like, yep, this is a human kidney.
Chain of evidence. Very important.
Not important in, what, 1890 or whatever.
No. So an article in the San Francisco Evening Bulletin also cast doubt on the skull's authenticity, reporting that one of the miners who discovered the skull had, quite gleefully, I imagine, confessed to a local minister that they had planted the skull specifically as a joke on Whitney, as he was, quote, an Easterner of very reserved demeanor.
Sorry, I was trying to close the
Did
closet
you fall?
Behind me. Yes. An Easterner of what?
An Easterner of very reserved demeanor.
The hell does that mean?
He had a stick up his butt.
Oh, he was uptight. Okay. Well, I don't know. Let him be uptight. Who gives a shit?
Scholars at Harvard would run a fluorine analysis on the skull in 1879. So this is before radiocarbon dating. They did, like, they would measure how much fluorine are in the bones, because bones who have been in the ground longer absorb more fluoride from the groundwater. So
are you saying the groundwater is fluoridated, Sarah?
Yes, by the aliens.
Yeah, you know, the earth is controlling our minds with that natural fluoridation.
But these tests did conclude that it was probably more recent than, you know, several million years old. By this point, the skull was so infamously a fraud that a writer penned a satirical poem called To the Pliocene Skull. The narrator of the poem beseeches the skull to tell him of eras long past, of their time spent among ancient flora and fauna, and quote, cheerful pterodactyls, my favorite line of the poem, only for the skull to reply in the last stanza that his crust was busted falling down a shaft in Calaveras County and politely requesting that his remains be returned to his home state of Missouri. It's a good poem. Go look it up.
That's just a lot of effort to like burn someone.
I was going to read it like fully as part of this episode, but it was very long, or well, longer than I wanted to read. And also it had a lot of big words in it, and I didn't want to figure out how to pronounce it.
Fair enough.
Despite all this, Whitney continued to believe the skull was genuine until his death in 1896, and he was replaced at Harvard by F.W. Putnam, who continued to advocate for the skull's authenticity.
All of these names just sound like guys that sell patent medicines at like traveling shows.
Yeah, it's that era for sure. In 1901, determined to settle the matter once and for all, Putnam did some research on the circumstances surrounding the skull's discovery. And while in California, he learned that a number of Native American skulls had been dug up by a nearby burial site in 1865, a year before the find, because people are awful.
Uh-huh.
And supposedly, it was one of those skulls that had been planted in the Bald Mountain Mine. And at the very least, it presented a believable explanation for the skull's origin. However, after carefully comparing the skull with the descriptions of the one found in the mine, investigators became doubtful that they were even the same skull.
Oh, God.
Like, it's entirely possible it got switched out with another sometime between the discovery and the time it made its way to Whitney, which, like, was not helping matters, because then it adds, like, this layer of doubt, like, oh, well, maybe this isn't the skull, and the first skull they found was genuine, and, like, no, but it gives people something to point to say it could still be genuine. Because of all this, Putnam kind of wavered in his conclusion, so he only went as far to declare that, quote, it may be impossible ever to determine the satisfaction of the archaeologist, the place where the skull was actually found. Which, like, sure, you're never gonna, like, you can't conclusively prove that, but, like, I think we've got enough circumstantial
evidence. At this point, there are so many cooks in the kitchen that, like, let's just call it a day.
Yeah. In 1992, radiocarbon dating of the skull confirmed that it was almost certainly less than 1,000 years old. Ironically, some creationists are really into the skull, not because they consider it like genuine, but because they think it's proof that, you know, paleontologists ignore evidence that doesn't fit their theories, which completely ignores the fact that it was like really only Whitney and Putnam, and everybody else kind of thought that they were idiots. So,
well, I mean, that's also a creationist thing, is selectively,
well, choosing, yeah, I mean,
their evidence.
Very
so
unbranded.
Who's the idiot now?
The next artifact we're going to learn about is, for once, not a rock. It is known as the Tiara of Sitifernus. It's a fancy,
yeah, that sounds like a real a thing hoax. And not like...
At the end of the 19th century, Greek and Scythian artwork from Russia was like the hot new thing among European museums.
Did you say Greek artwork from Russia?
Yeah. So I'm fuzzy on all the details. I did look into this a little bit. So like Scythian are people who like they would have lived in like they would have been like Greek in origin, but like moved to kind of like what modern day like Crimea would be.
Okay.
So they had some like Greek influences, but they lived elsewhere. Yeah. So all these antiquities were showing up, these like beautiful like coins and jewelry and like beautiful stuff like that. These were being discovered at archaeological sites of like previous Scythian cities in modern day Crimea and Ukraine. So
kind of like kind how of the there's a bunch of Roman about. Shit in England.
Yeah. Yeah. I think kind
okay.
of like that.
Okay.
Not so much that they were colonizers, more so like they just moved, but yeah.
Okay.
So in 1895, there was a brief story in a Vienna newspaper about Crimean peasants fleeing Russia out of fear that their government would confiscate the newly, an incredible archaeological find that they had just discovered. The following year, some, quote, newly recovered Russian antiquities were displayed in Vienna, including a pointed dome-like tiara, 7 inches tall and forged from a pound of solid gold.
Jesus.
Serious tiara. It looks like a pointy hat.
I'm just picturing Princess Peach's crown, but I'm sure it's fancier than that.
The tiara depicted scenes of Scythian daily life on its lower bands, while upper tiers depicted scenes of like the Greek myth of the Iliad. It's literally like kind of like not a birthday hat shape because it's a little rounder than that, but like think that's kind of like how tall it is. So kind of like sits on top of the head. It doesn't have like the open, like pointy things. It's just kind of like a dome that sits on top of your head, but it's all made of gold.
It sounds ugly, but okay.
Yeah. There will be pictures on Instagram. It was believed to be a gift from the ancient Greek colony to a Scythian king. An inscription read, "The council and citizens of Olbia honor the great and invincible King Sitaphernus." So the story, as it was believed, was that Sitaphernus had besieged the colony and was only convinced to leave after being bribed with several expensive and shiny trinkets. I do believe that story is, like, he was a real person. This really happened, or at least there was a legend about it.
Okay.
So not saying that, like, that was made up, but...
Just the hat.
While both the British Museum and the Imperial Court Museum in Vienna passed on offers to buy the tiara, the Louvre in Paris quickly snatched it up, paying a reported 200,000 francs for the artifact.
That's a lot of hot dogs.
A lot of money. A lot of hot dogs indeed. That was a good joke.
No, it wasn't, but thank you.
Scholars, however, immediately cast doubt on the tiara's authenticity, in part due to its amazing state of preservation. There was almost no damage at all, and there were also traces of modern tools and soldering techniques, but, you know, details.
It's that last one that really, really chips it.
Yeah, but the Louvre had just paid 200,000 francs for this, so they were like, nah.
It's real.
It's definitely real. But in 1903, the newspaper Le Matin published a letter by a Russian jeweler who claimed that his friend, Israel Roshamovsky, the name I can pronounce, an artist from Odessa, had created the tiara. Roshamovsky was brought to Paris, and on being questioned by the Louvre, the artist claimed that he had been commissioned to create the tiara by art dealers who had eventually sold it. Who in turn had told him that, you know, they were making it for a friend of theirs who was an archaeologist and was into this sort of thing.
I mean, he's just, you know, it's like blaming someone at a copy shop for having a fake Van Gogh. I don't think they're going to Kinko's to make fake Van Goghs, no. But, you know.
He was given books showing Greco-Scythian artifacts and even pointed the exact ones out to investigators when they asked. He was then handed a sheet of gold and asked to prove his skill. And once he had successfully replicated a portion of the tiara, the Louvre investigators were forced to admit that their prized tiara was, in fact, a big old fake.
I mean, it's still pretty. Well, no, it sounds ugly in shape, but, like, it's still a nice piece.
Yeah.
And in the modern art museum.
The thing is, like, there is a happy ending in that once the story hit the press, demand for Roshamovsky's work skyrocketed.
Hell yeah.
And he had quite a successful career. Everyone was like, wow, you did make a really cool tiara. It wasn't real in that it wasn't historical, but it was still pretty. Cool. Good for him.
Good for him.
The Louvre still owns the tiara. They don't display it and probably never will again. But it was exhibited at least once in 1954 as part of a Salon of Fakes alongside 8 Mona Lisas.
I feel like a traveling exhibit of famous hoaxes, including like that giant from the last episode on hoaxes and like the big rock and this tiara. Like, I'd definitely go see it.
I would find that fascinating, and I feel like that would be really informative. Like, that's such a great angle of, like, history to consider, which is why I'm doing episodes about it, I guess, because I think hoaxes are neat, just like rocks.
Someone still had to make it, and, like, there's still a whole play. Like, there's still a very interesting story. It's just not the story that people, you know,
thought it was. Like, the story is interesting from, like, why do people do this, and why do people believe these things? Like,
sometimes
that's a cool
they're just assholes.
Sometimes they're just assholes and people think they need to be pranked. And sometimes people are just desperate. Like, this is also kind of like the general running theme you'll notice in a lot of these stories is like people want to believe it's true because, you know, they want to write a book about it or they just spent 200,000 francs on it. Like, they have very good reasons to want to believe in its authenticity, and that is a very powerful drug.
Admitting you're wrong is, I mean, how do you think cults happen? It's just a bunch of people who are like, I'm too far into this. I can't back out now.
No, I'm too.
Pretty sure that's why a lot of like international, you know, incidents happen too. Like,
oh, for sure. I think that's a very common human foible.
Just admit you're wrong, man. Sometimes it's better.
All right. We've got another skull. This one's named Piltdown Man.
Sounds familiar.
This is a pretty well-known one. So in 1907, a sand mine worker in Germany discovered a jawbone of a species that would eventually be named Hobo Heidelbergensis. It's a long word and it has a lot of letters. Heidelbergensis.
Okay. Yeah.
a 200,000 to 600,000 year old hominin. So like not human, but like kind of approaching human. Touted as like the missing
Neanderthal
link.
Tribe.
Yeah, for sure. The find displayed characteristics, literally of both Neanderthals and modern day humans. And because we were rapidly approaching Great War, led to something of an inferiority complex among British naturalists. they were disappointed that it was a German who did the thing. Men are weird. It's a bone, you guys. But this bone is not our hoax.
Is real.
That sounds pretty legit. Yeah. But it was pretty convenient that, like, only a year later, a man named Charles Dawson learned of a very interesting bone fragments uncovered by workmen near Piltdown, a village in southern England.
Yep. You know, it's because of naturalists back in that time period that, like, racism as we know it exists. You ever think about that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. These are the same guys who were justifying why white men were the superior race. So
we had to classify
keep that in the back of your mind.
I'm not saying that naturalists are bad people. Like, David Attenborough is a wonderful human. But, you know, the old-timey ones kind of fuck some shit up.
A little bit.
As we're about to hear, I'm sure.
Yeah. Oh yes. Dawson began his own excavations and would later write to his friend Sir Arthur Smith Woodward, a paleontologist and head of the Department of Geology at the British Museum. So he claimed he had dug up a thick portion of human ?
Ew. I don't like that phrasing. It makes it sound like it's a hamburger patty.
Yeah, you slurp that
just
on
a big old slab of dude.
Ew. Yep. Which will rival H. Heidelbergensis. I think it is Bergensis. I don't know. Someone else tell me how to pronounce it. I should have looked it up. Charles Dawson was a solicitor by trade and an amateur fossil hunter in his free time, because this was 1912, and if you were a rich white guy, that was just something you could do as a hobby.
Yeah.
Dawson and Smith Woodward presented their findings to the Geological Society of London in 1912. So what they had found was a skull, a mandible or jawbone, some teeth, and some stone tools. They estimated their age to be around 500,000 years old, and while the skull was distinctly human, the mandible was decidedly ape-like.
Were they the same? Like, did the skull have its own mandible, or
I believe they were found
the jaw, right?
They were found separately. The skull did not have its own mandible, but they were found very nearby. So the assumption was that they were from the same person.
Never assume.
Dubbed the Piltdown Man, the discovery was immediately embraced by researchers in the UK, thrilled to finally have their own version of the missing link and one that suggested the British Isles could have been a very important site of early human evolution.
That's the problem. It was, but not like that.
Yeah, well, you know, suck it, Germany.
You need to not get into pissing contests with the Germans or the French.
Though not everybody in the scientific community was uncritical of Dawson's discovery. I completely said that with the wrong intonation. Not everyone in the scientific community was uncritical of Dawson's discovery. Many pointed out that the jawbone and skull were too dissimilar from each other. Interesting. And that just because they had supposedly been found in close proximity didn't necessarily mean that they were from the same creature. So still, a majority of folks were on the side of Dawson and Woodward. And for at least three decades, the Piltdown skull was generally accepted as an authentic artifact.
I'm assuming it wasn't.
No, this did not last long. So the thing is, you know, as we continue digging up bones and skulls, paleontologists start to see, you know, more skeletons of early man and get more examples to look at. It soon becomes very apparent that the Piltdown Man is drastically different than anything else in the fossil record.
It's almost like having more information makes you more informed about previous things.
Yeah, interesting that. So like, yeah, so essentially just like this skull, like as you start to find more samples and more like, you know, artifacts and fossils, like you start to like be able to kind of like piece together kind of like how everything like changed and it was linked together.
Yeah.
And this was such an outlier to any of that. It just didn't match the bigger picture. So in 1953, a team of researchers at the British Museum decided they were going to put the skulls through some tests, including that fluorine dating that we were talking about earlier.
And should have done it sooner, but yeah, you know, whatever.
Tests revealed that while the upper skull dated back maybe about 600 years, which
that's impressive,
about 100,000 years like 600,000 years less than what he was hoping for, but still.
Well, yeah, but like it's still a 600-year-old skull. That's cool. Yeah,
that's pretty impressive. The mandible, though, was only a few decades old.
It is a monkey mandible, isn't it?
It had also been artificially stained with potassium dichromate in order to make it appear older. You are correct in that they also did not belong to the same species. The skull was from a human. The jaw was probably an orangutan.
They fucking aged it like a kid making an old-timey map for a school project.
Yeah, you like dipped it in tea. I don't know.
Put it in the oven.
So there for a while, there was actually quite a bit of speculation as to who the actual hoaxer was. Like, obviously, Dawson is going to be the top suspect. But there's always kind of, there was always this question of like, you know, did Woodward actually know? Or was he like, you know, was he being bamboozled just like everybody else? It could have also been anyone else who worked on the excavation. There were a couple other people that were involved. Some even floated the idea that Sir Arthur Conan Doyle could have been the hoaxer since, you know, he lived nearby and was interested in paleontology. I don't believe this. I just feel like we needed an Arthur Conan Doyle cameo in this episode.
What? The biggest skeptic in all of, wait, right.
He was the one who believed in fairies
and shit.
Yeah.
It was Houdini that was like, bro.
Yeah.
You need to stop.
And it quite damaged
the relationship. Oh God, I'm the Arthur Conan Doyle. You're the Houdini.
Oh my God, I've never been that comparison before. Well, that says a lot about who we are as people.
Oh, it checks out, honestly.
Yeah. In 2009, a paleoanthropologist named Isabel de Grude decided she was going to look into this. So she put the materials, you know, she put them through CT scans, she did DNA tests, all sorts of fun experiments. And
it's nice to hear a woman's name.
Yes. I think
it's the first one in this entire episode.
I think she might be the only one in this episode. All right. This episode does not pass the Bechdel test.
Well, we are two women talking. Theoretically, it does.
But we're talking about men, though.
But we're talking about a woman right now who's named. Yeah.
Oh, true. That's true. Okay. Good.
There you go.
This episode doesn't pass the Bechdel test. Great. So they were able to determine that the mandible and teeth were likely from the same orangutan whose bones probably were obtained from a curiosity shop because you could just, you know, pop in and buy these things.
Just buy those.
Yeah. Just buy monkey bones. The human bones.
That was a good movie.
Yeah. The human bones, meanwhile, were likely from at least two individuals. The De Groot was able to extract DNA and radiocarbon dating failed. So we weren't able to learn a lot about that. The CT scans did reveal something even more interesting. Putty used to fill in gaps in seal over places where gravel had been stuffed into the bones. So fossilized bones are apparently heavier than like just regular old bones. So De Groot believes that the forger had like added pebbles and stuff in order to give the bones some weight. And then, yeah. So like,
it would
have some heft.
Just thinking of that episode of I think it was The Office where Jim was putting pennies in Dwight's phone to slowly make it heavier. And then he took all the pennies out.
Yeah. That's a prank.
That's a prank.
Don't plant 2,000 stones in a mountain somewhere. So De Groot did conclude that due to the consistency of the technique, it was very likely the work of a single forger, and that single forger was probably Dawson. Not only would he have had some knowledge about what prehistoric finds would look like, but he was real thirsty for the Royal Society and really wanted to be a member.
About all of the stuff that's happened because we didn't want the Germans to have it. Like, I don't know, the atomic bomb.
You know, little things like that. Yeah.
Just little stuff like that.
So Dawson was also the one who discovered the fossils. He was the one who brought them to attention by sharing them with Woodward. And also, conveniently, no more fossils were found at this site following his death in 1916. And also, he dug up a lot of stuff that actually eventually was found to be fake. So probably that.
He was a big old liar pants then.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what wanting social validation gets you, I guess.
Well, I mean, he didn't live to see the downfall of his lies, so he technically got away with it. It
worked out in his favor, yeah, I guess. But now he's got two idiot podcasters making fun of him, so who really wins?
Which, that's the real punishment. That's why I'm okay with, like, comedy true crime podcasts, because what punishment is worse than having two fucking idiots just read you to filth?
just piss all over your legacy. Yeah, good for us.
We're punishing people. We're taking the law into our own hands. We're like shitty Batman. Ooh, can you imagine a Batman villain just called the Podcaster?
Certainly. Certainly he exists. Probably one of those new modern Batman villains.
Yeah, it's a... Oh, fuck. Who did... The Riddler. Oh, God, it's the Riddler.
The Riddler. Did he have a podcast in the new Batman?
No, but... No, I feel like he probably would have. He did, like, a bunch of Reddit stuff.
Yeah, he definitely had a podcast.
Mark my words, the Riddler would have a podcast.
Yeah.
I think the Riddler... And Bane would probably, he has a voice for radio.
Yes. He would definitely have like a Joe Rogan type podcast.
Oh, God. No, the Joker would have a Joe Rogan podcast.
Oh, no, that's a much better comparison. Yeah. The Joker 100% has a podcast.
These are the important discussions.
Now that we've determined all this. All right. Our next one is Drake's Plate of Brass, which sounds very fancy.
It sounds like a an item from Dungeons and Dragons.
It very much does. That's definitely the vibe. So in 1579, Francis Drake landed at Drake's Cove in Drake's Bay, California.
Jesus Christ.
That were named for him after the fact. That, like, wouldn't it be crazy if it was just a wild coincidence?
I was going to say if he had named them himself.
I don't know if he named them or they were just eventually named that way. I honestly also, don't know. It could be either.
Drake's Plate as a Dungeons and Dragons item. This is for all you nerds out there in case you need to add something. I would imagine it is like a gold platter, but when you stand on it, it raises you up a couple feet, like an elevator. So you started from the bottom and then.
I thought you meant like, you know, putting lifts in your shoes. So you just appear.
No, it's like
taller.
A little elevator. It's like a little elevator.
That would be cool.
That's all I got. You can do it once per day. There you go.
Yeah, there you go. So this landing, this was cool and all. And it does seem that one would want to commemorate the moment. So according to an account by a member of his party, Drake left behind an inscribed blast marker or plate. So not like a dinner plate, just like,
like a plaque.
Yeah. As, quote, a monument of our being there and claiming the land, of course, for Queen Elizabeth I of England, as you do.
Why do men have to do this all the time? It's like, I was here. You must know that I was here. I mean, I guess it's no different than like posting your vacation on Instagram now, but
you're
not claiming it for shit.
I was going to compare it to like just peeing on things, but same thing, I guess.
cider up my nose. That's exactly what it is.
It's just slightly more dignified, but it's same vibe.
The human version of peeing on something. Mm.
It said the plate included the date of the landing, Drake's name, and a sixpence coin bearing a portrait of the queen.
Of course.
Why not? So fast forward about 400 years to 1933, when a chauffeur by the name of William Caldera discovered a dirt-covered plate while hunting with his employer and a friend near the shores of Drake's Bay. His employer, Leon Baccaraz, and his friend, Anson Stiles Blake, were both prominent Berkeley alums and members of the California Historical Society.
Convenient.
Caldera's showed them the plate, which they found interesting, and then they stowed it in the trunk of the car to investigate later. Except they never did. They completely forgot about it. And while Caldera was cleaning out his car a few weeks later, he just kind of tossed it out.
It's like when you put the Goodwill stuff in the back of your car, like, I will take care of this. I just need to drive it around for 6 months first.
Yes, correct. So fast forward again, 3 years later, in 1936, a shop clerk by the name of Beryl Shin found the discarded plate and showed it to a friend who was a student at Berkeley. And this friend pointed him in the direction of Herbert Bolton, a professor of California history who had a particular interest in finding the plate. So over the years, he had encouraged his students to go look for it, which he believed it was probably somewhere still in the area. And if they ever found it, they were to ever found anything even close to matching the description, bring it to him. So
I imagine that getting a degree in Californian history in 1930, whatever, was probably pretty easy. As there was not like, a lot of it.
It was like 100 years of it. Yeah. Well, I imagine the studies go further past like white people arriving, probably.
Well,
I would hope.
You would hope.
So to say Bolton was thrilled probably was an understatement. He immediately alerted Alan Chickering, the president of the California Society, who offered to buy the plate from Shin for $2,500, which is like $50,000 today. But Shin wanted to show it to his uncle first, get his uncle's opinion on it. I don't know what his uncle was going to do, but you know, when 4 days passed without a word from Shin, Bolton and Chickering panicked and upped their price to $3,500 or about $70,000, which seemed to be acceptable enough to Shin. I would imagine so. The plate was then given to the Bancroft Library at the University of California in Berkeley. Bolton announced the find at a meeting of the California Historical Society in April 1937, claiming one of the world's long-lost historical treasures apparently has been found. The authenticity of the tablet seems to be beyond all reasonable doubt. Neither had actually conducted any thorough investigation into the plate beyond confirming that it matched the historical description.
See, and this episode is really just about bad scientists.
Yeah, interesting that. Skeptics pointed out at least a few inconsistencies. The plate used modern spelling, like it used like the in this.
This again.
Yeah, instead of like ye and yes, which were... which sounds silly, but were apparently how it was like... I don't know if it was actually pronounced that way, but like, you know, like none of the like tis and thou that you would expect like an Elizabethan era writing. And it referred to the queen simply as Queen Elizabeth and not, quote, the standard, quote, oh, Elizabeth, God. By the grace of God, Queen of England, France, and Ireland, defender of the faith.
I'm going to start answering the phone like that.
I was going to say, if we still refer to King Charles like this, maybe the man could get a little respect.
Oh, he probably doesn't deserve it.
So beyond the wording, the plate seemed to be, you know, a little too uniform. Its patina was kind of unconvincing, but that apparently wasn't enough to settle the matter. Chickering published a defense of the plate in the same issue of California Monthly, where these critiques were raised. And after a fellow Berkeley professor confirmed the plate as genuine in 1938, I guess everybody apparently shrugged and started putting it in textbooks, because why not?
It's just like, whatever. Like, it grand scheme, maybe doesn't matter that much.
Yeah. So it wouldn't be until decades later that the plate was seriously reexamined. In 1977, while making preparations for the 400th anniversary of Drake's Landing, Professor James D. Clark, who was then the director of the Bancroft Library, asked for detailed analysis of the plate by researchers there at Berkeley, as well as some at Oxford. So, you know, getting a second opinion.
Getting second and third opinions.
Yeah. The tests, which included x-ray diffraction, stereo microscopy, and metallurgical analysis, revealed what I'm sure all of our listeners have probably guessed, because the name of this episode is Hoaxes and Not Neat Things Found in the Dirt.
Technically, that's also still true.
True. The plate had been made using modern cutting and rolling equipment, using modern American brass.
Yeah, but did they ever ask that guy's uncle his opinion?
I don't think we ever got Shin's uncle's opinion, which is too bad. In 2003, it was revealed that the plate had been created as a practical joke by members, another one of these, of the ancient and honorable order of E. Clampus Vitus, or ECV, which was a very unserious fraternity of California history enthusiasts that was known for playing pranks on its members, of which Herbert Bolton was one. They had even painted ECV on the back in paint that would be visible under ultraviolet light, but apparently no one ever thought to look for it.
I'm imagining every single scientist or historian in that order as being played by either Donald Glover or Jack Quaid.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just like kind a of flock the vibe. Of them.
It doesn't seem like any of the hoaxers actually intended for the brass plate to have been taken seriously. They even tried to tip off Bolton a couple of times that the plate could be a hoax, but
oh my God.
By then, Bolton had already publicly announced its discovery, and it seems like they kind of like didn't press the matter because they didn't want to embarrass him.
So it wasn't like a malicious prank. Like, they tried to fix it. It wasn't like we made 2,000 stones and we just got caught.
No, I think they probably thought, and like, I think part of the reason was like, they intended it probably to be found earlier than it was and not by the people it was found by, you know, like they planted it in a certain place. It was found by that initial group of people. I don't know if they like that initial group was supposed to find it or if they just like, but like, you know, at some point it gets moved, it gets tossed away. Someone else completely unconnected finds it. And they lose, you know, total control over the story. So, like, yeah, they're like, I think they like wrote some jokes in like their publication that kind of like hinted at it. And they like, even tried to like tell people to look for the paint and like it.
So they didn't want to blow up his spot, but they also didn't want him to keep going.
Yeah. They were trying to let him down gently and it just never happened. And then they couldn't do it more forcefully. Because he was too forcefully.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just admit you're wrong, man. Sometimes you have to be like, oh, interesting. I was wrong. And then just move on.
All right. So, of course, for our final hoax, we have to include at least one modern one, just to drive home the fact, again, that human beings
still happens,
no less gullible than we were in the centuries past. We just, you know, we are fortunate to have a little bit more knowledge on our hands. In October 1999, the National Geographic Society, you might know them from their magazine, held a major press conference to announce the discovery of a 125-million-year-old fossil in northeastern China. With arms of the primitive bird and the tail of a dinosaur, their magazine boasted, this creature is a true missing link in the complex chain that connects dinosaurs to birds. So, at this time, apparently, I don't remember this happening, but the question of whether birds were actually descended from dinosaurs was like still kind of a hotly debated topic. It wasn't settled. And so this fossil, which they dubbed Archaeoraptor, seemed to kind of settle the matter once and for all. Yeah, cool name.
It's fought Godzilla.
Yeah, it's not as cool as the name suggests. It would have been about the size of a turkey if that turkey had a dinosaur tail.
I saw a turkey the other day. Sorry. Apparently a pack of wild turkeys has moved into my grandma's neighborhood.
Oh, delightful.
Sort of. I guess they stop traffic frequently because they just stand in the middle of the road.
Yeah, we get a lot of like wild turkeys around these parts. Like there was one that used to live. I don't know if they lived, but I would frequently see them like on the exit ramp as I was getting on the highway. I'm used to seeing just wild packs of turkeys. We have a lot of them here.
I just think it's bad for the neighborhood to have these wild turkeys out there drinking.
Very funny. That was a good one.
No. I don't know. I just never seen a turkey in a neighborhood before. It was strange. And they're scary birds, honestly. Like, I know they're stupid as hell.
Like, I had turkeys like walk across my patio one day, and it was a bit of a shock. June was having the time of her God. Life. But like they're big birds.
That's gotta be like the cat equivalent of seeing a UFO.
Yeah. I didn't know they made birds this big.
Oh God. Don't know how to act.
It was this tail, this dinosaur tail, this bird had, that eventually would tip off researchers off to the fact that this dinosaur was a big old fake. So Xu Sheng, one of the Chinese scientists who initially helped identify the fossil, later happened to discover a second fossil containing the exact mirror image duplicate of the Archaeoraptor's tail attached to the body of a different dinosaur. So apparently fossil stones, when you take them from the ground, they usually kind of end up split in two. And, you know, the fossil is inside, obviously.
That's
how fossils work. So essentially you get like two duplicate images on two separate slabs. And it would later be revealed that a Chinese farmer had discovered fossils of a few different creatures. So they weren't real fossils. But he had taken one of the slabs with the tail fossil and attached it to the fossil of the bird.
Kind of like that Fiji mermaid thing.
Very much a modern day Fiji mermaid. He sold his find to a Chinese dealer who went on to sell it to a dinosaur museum in the U.S. And then when National Geographic found out about it, they rushed to publish the story before it had actually been peer reviewed. So good job. This is why you always wait for peer review.
Yes. Always investigate before you're like, look at this shit that I found. Just like give it a couple weeks, get a second, a third opinion, have your uncle look at it. Just don't say anything yet.
Yeah. So National Geographic would admit to their mistake in March 2000. And when the press found out about it, U.S. News and World Report dubbed the find the Piltdown Chicken, which is a very good joke.
Oh.
End of episode.
Man, I'm not going to say people are stupid because, like, what the hell else are we supposed to think?
Yeah. And again, like, if it's confirming something you already want to believe is true, it's really hard.
It's easier to believe.
It's easier to believe. It's easier to, like, overlook the evidence that may suggest otherwise. It's just a very human thing. But it does make for some fun stories.
Well, if, like, a science person told me, like, this is the skull of a 2 million year old man. Like, I don't have other information to be like, maybe it's not, though. Like, I would trust them because that's their job.
Yes. And, you know, I will say you should believe in science, obviously. But scientists are also human and scientists do make mistakes. And the fortunate thing is there are usually other scientists who will eventually correct those mistakes. But
that's just kind of how science has always worked.
Essentially, we figure out we're wrong and we do it better the next time. That's how it goes.
What a nice moral.
Maybe. I think. I mean, it should be. That should be a good thing. We should correct our mistakes. We should admit that we were wrong.
Yes. If you have new information, don't be afraid to like accept it and use it. Because that just means that you have more information. That's a good thing.
Yes. Correct. That is a great takeaway for this episode.
Man, I'm glad I could help. if you found a skull or a fossil in your field.
Send us rocks.
Please don't send us rocks. Send us pictures of rocks. I don't care about that.
I would love to see pictures of rocks. 100% genuine. You live
a thrilling life. you can email those pictures to afternoonifiedpod@gmail.com, or you can send them to us on Instagram at afternoonified. We are also on the web at afternoonified or getafternoonified.com, where you can find old episodes. You can buy merch. You can donate to the tip jar if the spirit moves you. Yeah, remember to rate, subscribe, review, all of that fun stuff. And we'll see you next week for a very cute
Yeah, it truly is. Goodbye. We love you.
For more podcasts like the one you just listened to, go to SoBelowMedia.com.
This is as above, so below.